The Global Jigsaw is the podcast lifting the language barrier to show you the world through its media.
Радіо Тегерану.
Ми не вторгались на територію України.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Richard Gagoy, and in this edition of Focus on Africa, will Senegal's president-elect, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, be able to step out of the shadow of his charismatic mentor, Ousmane Sonko?
So the victory of Diomaye Faye is largely constructed on the popularity and mobilization, the capacity of Sonko to galvanize the population, to galvanize the youth. And I believe he's going to continue to shepherd this development even in the coming days.
A hostage negotiator opens up on how ransom payments to kidnappers in northern Nigeria are done.
Payments are done in cash, as bank transfers can be traced, and payments are usually done by a parent or a relative of one of these abductees. The bandits will call them and give them step-by-step directions on how to find them in the bush.
And if you're living in East Africa, brace yourself. A climate expert warns of hotter days ahead.
With global warming in the future, we still expect that all these heat waves are likely to increase, and then also the intensity is also likely to be higher.
It's Tuesday, the 26th of March. Africa has perhaps walked into a new dawn. The opposition candidate, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, is set to become the new president of Senegal. At the age of just 44, he will be Senegal's youngest president. He was released from prison less than 2 weeks ago and owes much of his success to the backing of the opposition leader, Ousmane Sonko, who was barred from running due to a defamation conviction. Mr. Faye addressed the nation last night at a news conference as its new president-elect.
By electing me president, the Senegalese people have chosen to break with the past, to give substance to the immense hopes raised by our vision of society. I pledge to govern with humility and transparency and to fight corruption at all levels. I pledge to devote myself fully to rebuilding our institutions and strengthening the foundations of our way of life together.
There were celebrations on the streets of Dakar as news broke out about his win. For more on the atmosphere in the capital, I spoke to Borso Tal, a journalist who was there. Thank you so much for joining us on Focus on Africa podcast. It's great reconnecting with you once again.
Yes, it is. Thanks for having me.
Of course, I will be waiting for the official announcement of the results. But just give me some color here. What's been the atmosphere like in Senegal since the news broke out that Faye had really defied the odds to win the country's top job?
Well, many things happened. I think I would describe it in terms of layers. The first reaction immediately when the first results kind of dropped, beginning from the diaspora, many people were already cheering out immediately. People went out. I was outside in the car and people just passing by in all ways of transportation, honking, screaming, chanting, Ousmane, Ousmane, or chanting, Jomai is Ousmane and Ousmane is Jomai. Just very, very happy. That is the first reaction that we had until almost every day. But when the main candidate in opposition now, Amadou Ba, congratulated him, followed by, President Macky Sall and many others in the sub-region, even Macron congratulated him, there is peace in Senegal, there's calm. I was very surprised last night that I did not see any more cheering as I was on my way to the Radisson Blu, where he had held his first address. There was nothing. People were in their homes, seemingly, just cars by, nothing, very calm. And I think the lecture I have of that is that people are now relieved. Elections passed. Bassirou Diomaye Faye is at the top, congratulated by all those they did not expect to accept this immediately, which they did. A lot of rumors, I should call it now, say that President Sall was very stern in the respect of the transparency. Many others wanted to delay a little bit just to see how things could be done. But President Sall was very clear from the very beginning that he would want a transparent vote, and which he did. Seemingly, that's what made it very easy for the first results to be accepted.
All right. And, you know, there are a lot of concerns, you know, in the run-up to the polls itself. So tell me something about him, because he was largely seen as a political newcomer. He was relatively unknown. In fact, he wasn't actually the first choice of his party. So who's this man?
This man is just a young man born in 1980. So very, very young in the eyes of those who've always seen presidents come in their late 40s or 50s. He is from a village in Mbour, which is about 2-3 hours away from Dakar. And he is just a regular person who would go on vacation back to his village in the farm. That's what he's done most of his personal life. Married to two women, one whom he married a little bit before going to prison. And he used to work for the Employé Domaine. He was like a tax whistleblower, just like Ousmane Sonko, and that's where he met him. So Ousmane Sonko was there before him. They had very close relationships to this day. As you mentioned, no one knew him before, but he is at the core of the PASTEF project, at the very core of it. And that's why, whereas it was a surprise to everyone, to Ousmane, he mentioned it. It was not a surprise to him. He's known him very well for a very long time, and he even trusts him more than he trusts himself. That's what he said in the past few months.
So does he owe much of his success to Ousmane Sonko, who now openly, you know, backed his presidential bid?
Most definitely. I think Jomai would not have become what he is now on his own, as he's a very timid person, not political at all. He even said that he was not interested in politics at all until he was pushed into it by Ousmane Sonko. And he is just kind of falling into it now. People are saying that, is he ready? Just last night when he was addressing the nation, the press, I should say, for the first time, he was kind of, you know, reading his text more than probably he should, according to some people. Some people talked about how his tie was fixed, etc. But all this is just the very beginning, a very timid beginning, but rest assured.
Right. After a very competitive and grueling, you know, campaign season. Really appreciate your time, Borso Tal.
Thank you.
Journalist Borso Tal. But will Basiho Jiomai Fai's rise bring stability and economic prosperity after 3 years of unprecedented political turbulence, which saw several waves of deadly anti-government protests? Professor Oluwole Ojewale works at the Institute of Strategic Studies in Dakar. Dr. Oluwole, really appreciate your time once again for joining us on Focus on Africa. So the last time we spoke here, things weren't really looking good in Senegal. Height of the political turbulence, anti-government protests, a lot of concerns around the elections that just happened a few days ago. Right now we have, you know, the continent's, you know, youngest democratically elected leader. What does this really mean for democracy in the continent? Is it a boon? Is it a boost?
Thank you so much. I think it's a welcome development, and we are all excited because it sounds like an anti-climax when you look at the political turbulence of the past 3 years. The headlines were screaming, Senegal on the head, Senegal on the brink, and then a whole lot of apocalyptic display of what is likely going to happen in Senegal. Some even thought about unconstitutional change of government. But I think Senegalese people and the events that have culminated in the emergence of the youngest democratically elected leader shows that hope can spring from Senegal. Senegal is indeed the bastion of democracy in this region. And they've now surpassed that record by also giving us the first young president, youngest democratically elected president in the region. So I think we are not far from realities of what is going to begin to shape and determine democratic events in the coming days in the region, particularly when you look at what has happened in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. So indeed, as West African citizens, we are happy that things have played out the way it has played out, and indeed that hope for democracy is springing forth from here. And democratic solidarity is on the advancement from Senegal. The people have spoken, the people have demonstrated resilience, and it's a lesson that can be shared for other countries to emulate in the region.
And what was his relationship with Ousmane Sonko, who's been really a very popular political figure amongst the youth, who make up 60% of the country's population, majority of them just under 25? Because we didn't know so much about Dioma Faye, because he is seen largely as a political newcomer, relatively unknown. And in fact, he wasn't actually the first choice of his party.
Yes, I think he rose on the wings of popularity and mobilization of Sonko. We can't separate his rising, his emergence from the democratic architecture of mobilization that Sonko has put in place in the past. You know, Sonko contested the previous election, and he has contested this one. I mean, he attempted to contest this one again before he started facing political persecution. So the victory of Dioma Faye is largely constructed on the popularity and mobilization, the capacity of Sonko to galvanize the population, to galvanize the youth. And I believe he's going to continue to shepherd this development even in the coming days, irrespective of the roles that he's probably going to play, whether in government or even as the leader of a party.
And I'm curious to know what really happens to the outgoing president, Macky Sall, who had been really accused of attempting to stay on in power, not just for a month or two, but for an extended period of time. Of course, so we've heard from him here on the BBC in an interview last week, denying that he was planning to hold on to power. So what really happens to him?
I think those rumors are true, and we can't rule them out, the possibility of the third term agenda and even the extension of stay in power. But what happened is that the people power is stronger than political power, and that is what has been demonstrated here in the past 3 years. In fact, I used to describe it as protest on repeat, because every day, whether Sonko is going to court or anything, you see people mobilizing and mobilizing every day. And let me tell you something that I found very striking here as an observer and a resident who just moved here in the last 3 years. Anytime I go on the street and I talk to the people, looking at the political development from the lens of Nigeria where I came from, and I tell them that what about if the president want to contest, Senegalese will almost beat their chest and tell you categorically that the man cannot stay in that corridor of power beyond April 2nd. I find that very audacious, but I tell you, it is the people's resistance that has limited those tendencies that you mentioned, and that has paved the way for the emergence of a young democratically elected leader now. So it is the people's resistance, internal and external, the diaspora Senegalese, they put pressure on social media. People were demonstrating on the ground, and on the final analysis, all those architecture of third-term agenda, they have to collapse under the weight of these people's resistance.
And just looking ahead, because I know there's a lot of attention or maybe speculation around his foreign, policy. One of the things that we've noticed is that just across the entire West Africa region, specifically in the Sahel, there's been the anti-West sentiment, and specifically focusing on France, has indicated what his relationship will be with Paris.
I think what is important is that we must be able to separate campaign populism from what is going to be the reality when you get into power. They are two different things. I believe those things are probably said to woo gullible voters to their side. The reality is that you have to negotiate, you have to engage diplomatically when you go there. I know that a lot of people talk about decoupling from France, abandoning the CFA and all those anti-French sentiments. I believe the Pandora box is going to be different completely when it gets into power. It is not a Tea Party affair. What they need to do is to negotiate better deals for their people, for their country, but that they are going to completely decouple from the French establishment, I don't think it's going to be an easy task, and it can derail the country from the path of development. I'm not saying this to be self-serving, to say maybe all the external influences and interest here has actually delivered development for the people. That is not what I'm saying. But I'm saying there is a clear dichotomy between political populism of campaign, from rallies and all those things, to actual governance in government. So if he wants to carry out those tasks, I think it's going to be an uphill task. You need to navigate carefully, and it's going to take time. It's not a Tea Party affair.
All right, Dr. Luole Ojewale, thank you so much for those insights. Really appreciate for your time. It's been great having you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Over 100 school children who were recently kidnapped in northwest Nigeria have, according to government officials, been released. Earlier this month, it was reported that more than 280 students were taken from the town of Kuriga in Kaduna State. It is a crisis that the region has been grappling with for the past decade, with thousands of people seized for ransom. With the government struggling to put an end to the industry, local community members have turned to informal negotiators to help them get their loved ones back. But as ransom payments were made illegal in Nigeria since 2022, it is a dangerous and controversial task. The BBC's Chris Ewoko has been speaking to a kidnap negotiator who has admitted that he does pay ransoms. We have voiced over his answers to protect his identity. I spoke to Chris, who's in Abuja, for more. We've covered here extensively on Focus on Africa podcast about kidnappings in parts of northern Nigeria. What we know is that Nigeria, like many other countries, do not encourage the payment of ransoms because that, in effect, encourages, you know, kidnappers. But the negotiator you spoke to openly say that he does. How did he justify that?
Well, the payment of ransom to kidnappers in Nigeria is a very tricky issue. As a matter of fact, Nigeria's President Bola Ahmed Tinubu came out recently to say that the bandits who kidnapped the over 280 school children from Kuriga in Kaduna State will not be paid a penny. But while the government has made ransom payment illegal, it has not also put in place a commensurate strategy that could bring kidnapping to an end. Yeah, of course, they've brought in the military and have had some successes where they've killed several high-profile bandit leaders. But the number of bandits are so large, it's difficult to manage. Now, the negotiator I spoke to said that dialogue between the government and the bandits is key.
Negotiation with the bandits is not the solution because it is encouraging more kidnapping. Paying ransom is helping the kidnapping. The government has to do something different. The military have been fighting the armed gangs for 5 years, but there is no result. If I can advise the government, they should meet these people and have dialogue with them. Most of these bandits are not enjoying life. If you ask them, if you get your cows back and get amnesty, will you stop doing this kidnapping? They say yes.
And so Chris, speaking about dialogue, in the course of this conversation, what did you pick from him about the process of negotiating with bandits?
Well, as you would expect, engaging in hostage negotiations with bandits in Nigeria, as we were made to understand during the conversation, is a very dangerous and delicate process. Each negotiation is different because, as he said, there are so many gangs. One US-based think tank estimated that there are about 30,000 bandits operating in northwestern Nigeria, and they are split into over 100 groups. The negotiator thinks so too. However, he has had a lot of successes. He told us that since 2021, he has helped the release of over 200 hostages. He also told us that it's about being patient, using the right language, and trying to sympathize with their cause. As he said, much of insecurity has been fueled by high poverty rates and unemployment. So they say that they have been driven into crime. Here's what the negotiator told us.
When I speak to the bandits, I understand those people. I tell them that I know they are living a difficult life in the bush without electricity. I know that they feel they have been forgotten by the government. You have to use soft language. They can be rude and they will insult you, but you have to remain calm. Payments are done in cash, as bank transfers can be traced and payments are usually done by a parent or a relative of one of these abductees. The bandits will call them and give them step-by-step directions on how to find them in the bush. Sometimes, bandits request motorcycles as part of the ransom payment, as well as alcohol and cigarettes.
Right, Chris. So then how common is it for informal or unofficial negotiators to get involved when a kidnapping has taken place?
It's difficult to say how many informal negotiators are currently operating in Nigeria's northwest. They really don't come out openly to declare it, but families who have been helped know them and they pass on the information. We know that some people in the communities in the region have turned to people also in the community to help them speak to the bandits. And as they feel the government has failed to help them, there are a couple of well-known and high-profile negotiators that have been known to help people get released from Boko Haram and armed gangs. But it's a dangerous and controversial job, as in 2022, Nigeria government made ransom payment illegal, and they have taken a hard stance against speaking and negotiating with bandits. But there are unofficial reports that local authorities are still making ransom payments, though it's still something the government denies. When we spoke to the kidnapped negotiator in Nigeria, he told us how he got involved.
I did not intend to get involved in hostage negotiations. The first time I spoke to the bandits was after several of my family members were kidnapped and I had to negotiate their release. I did not know what I was doing. I was just speaking with them and begging them. I was so scared because the government does not like negotiations with the bandits and can send people to jail for doing that. After my family members were released, people in the community heard that I spoke to the bandits and wanted me to also help them get their loved ones back. We have to negotiate. You cannot use force to get hostages back. It would put the lives of our loved ones in danger.
And so finally, Chris, there are reports about the release of school children who were abducted in Kaduna State in northern Nigeria over 2 weeks ago. And that's according to the state government. We're just curious to know, how did this happen very, very fast? And do we know if any ransom was paid?
Okay, it seems a bit fast, especially considering the fact that the deadline given by the kidnappers before they could release the children was 3 weeks. And in less than 2 weeks, the children have been released. But again, put into consideration the fact that there are, you know, anxious parents at home waiting to see their children. Now, there's a bit of a controversy over the number of those children. What we learned from the Kaduna State government is that 137 pupils were rescued. But what we do know is that over 280 of them were abducted. So the whereabouts of about 150 others are still unknown. And on Monday, the government got the children, they bathed them, some were taken to hospital, and they were being reunited with their parents. But the government has not come out to specifically say if they paid ransom. But as you would imagine, we've been speaking with a ransom negotiator, you know. So it's going to be difficult for the government to come out openly to say that it paid ransom. But we do know unofficially that negotiations may have been going on, but government is not going to own up to that. How they managed to get 137 of these pupils out of captivity is what we are anxious to know, which the government is also not telling.
All right, Chris, thank you so much for unpacking, you know, the dynamics of negotiating with kidnappers. It's been great talking to you on Focus on Africa podcast.
Thank you very much, Richard.
The BBC's Chris Ewoko in Abuja.
If you're listening in East Africa, you will know that there's a pretty major heatwave going on at the moment. Here in Nairobi, for example, we've recorded highs of 34 degrees, something last experienced a decade ago. Other parts of the continent, too, have experienced unusually high temperatures in recent months. Climate scientists recently confirmed that a heatwave in West Africa in February was caused by climate change. Well, in South Sudan, the government was forced to act this past week. With temperatures soaring, they took the decision to close schools for at least 2 weeks. They're advising all children to stay indoors, as temperatures could reach an exceptional 45 degrees Celsius. In a minute, you'll hear from a climate expert as to why this is happening. But first, I had a chat with Lucy Amose, who works at the International Federation of the Red Cross in Juba, whose 11-year-old son, Ladu, is now at home.
Today is hot as usual. So as I talk now, the temperature is 41. But during the day, it was about 43, 44.
That's really hot. Has it ever been like this before? Have you ever experienced something like this before?
Not at all. It has never been like that. It is actually my first time to experience this kind of heat wave.
Just being reported across, South Sudan, it's not just Juba and its environs.
That's right. It's not only Juba. Actually, Juba and the rest of the states, actually the whole of South Sudan is experiencing this hot wave everywhere.
I wonder how you're coping with this heat.
Wow, it's not easy actually. We're actually trying our best, but it is not easy. As like parents who are working, we as adults, we try actually to cope by staying indoors, staying in the office, staying under shade. But our worry is about our children that we live back home alone while we are working. And we are actually always thinking how they are staying back home. You know, children, you can't stop them when you're not around. They're always playing outdoor and they will not even think of being hydrated. They'll always not think that let me drink water before I get thirsty. So it's us, their parents, who are always there to remind them, please come drink water, please sit under the shade, please don't run there. And they always experience headache. And then when they are all alone home, when they experience the headache, they thought it is actually the normal headache. And they run and ask for Panadols from their siblings, from their older siblings. And always they're on Panadol, thinking that it is really headache, but it's not headache. It's just because there's no one who is taking care of them, telling them to take water. And when we are home as parents, we at least tell them, please take water and don't play outdoors, be under the shade. And that's how we could control them. But our worry is leaving them home alone with the close of the schools, which we don't know when the schools are going to open again, is a bit challenging to us as parents. And if you look at kids around, most of them have heat rash and always they are running temperatures. Children are at a higher risk at this time.
That must be, you know, very troubling. And of course, you've expressed your anxiety, especially when you're not in the company of your children. So it's not just affecting the environment, but of course, even taking its toll on people's health. And like, as you have described about the children there, have people sort of like eased in terms of the activities? What sort of disruption has this heat wave caused?
This heat has caused actually a lot of disruption. For example, we find that for the hawkers, because in South Sudan, everybody is trying to fix ends, and find that even those who are moving from one place to another, it's difficult for them to move on the hot sun, carrying their items to sell. It is actually difficult for them. And you find that when they're leaving home, they leave home early. And when they're going back home, they go back home late. And they're given the fact that even transport fares are a bit high.
Lucy Amose, a mother in Juba, South Sudan. So is this just a one-off event, or could it be part of a broader pattern? One regional organization that tracks weather patterns and predictions is the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD. And Dr. Marceline Godoshava is a climate expert with them.
When we talk about a heat wave, we are talking of hot temperatures that are sustained over a period of time. So there are different definitions when we refer to this period of time. Others use 3 days, others use 5 days. And maybe the next question will be, so what is it that you call hot temperatures? So hot temperatures are defined also differently. Some people use a threshold of 40 degrees over plains. And then when you're looking over hilly areas, you're referring to a temperature of 30 degrees. And you can also use percentiles. If I reach a percentile of this threshold, then this is a heat wave over this number of days. So you can look at it from a 90th percentile, 95th percentile, and say you have a heat wave.
In Nairobi, just slightly over a week ago, I think we had a record high of about, was it 34, 36 degrees? But then I'm told in other parts of the region, it's actually even higher. So which areas are recording the highest, you know, in terms of temperatures, which have been affected by this heat wave that you're defining?
Areas that are experiencing high temperatures over our region include the eastern parts of East Africa. So when you are looking at the coastal areas of Tanzania, Kenya, northern parts of Kenya, and then also looking at parts of Somalia, and then we also have parts of South Sudan. So South Sudan has been having temperatures, mean temperatures that are above 32 degrees. And we also have the western parts of Ethiopia.
I'm particularly interested in South Sudan because I saw the education minister there announcing that schools are going to be closed for, I think, for an indefinite period, because there's a, I think, a projection of about, you know, 2 weeks where they're going to be experiencing record temperatures. So how does that really compare to recent years?
So looking at it, I think this year has been warmer than what has been experienced before. So if we look at the current records, we see that February is recorded as the warmest month globally ever. So it has like temperatures that are about 1.77 degrees higher than the pre-industrial temperatures. So we can see that this year is quite warmer compared to what has been happening in the past.
So why are we experiencing, you know, the temperatures? Why are they so hot specifically for this region?
There are different factors that are affecting the region. So we can have like the global factors. So if you realize we are just coming from El Nino conditions, which are known for raising the global temperatures. And then within South Sudan, we also have pressure systems, high pressure systems and low pressure systems. So what is happening at this moment, it is surrounded by high pressure systems, and then we also have the Sudan thermal low. So with this happening, it's almost like South Sudan is kind of blanketed. So with this blanket, you don't have the heat escaping, so you have temperatures rising over those regions.
And just looking ahead, what can we learn from this? Are there particular predictions that you'd have for the region? Are we likely to see it becoming hotter?
So in the future, that's what we are expecting. With global warming in the future, we still expect that all these heat waves are likely to increase. And then also the intensity is also likely to be higher than what it is now.
Well, it sounds like some things are really beyond our control. But is there anything that can be done to reduce or to mitigate the impact?
I think there are some things that we can do in the long term. I think we really need to kind of like invest more into sort of forecasting these extreme events, so that when we have these extreme events, we are well prepared. And then we also kind of build the resilience such that we do not expect disruptions in our day-to-day life.
Dr. Marceline Gudoshava is a climate expert with EGERD. And that's it for this edition of Focus on Africa. This episode was produced by Sunita Nahar, Yvette Tajira Maria, Rob Wilson and Victor Silva in London. Paul Bachbinga was in charge, and our technical producer is Danny Cox. Andrew Lombard and Alice Modengi are our editors. Check out our sister podcast, Africa Daily. It's a deep dive into one new story shaping the continent. I'm Richard Kagoe. We'll talk again next time.
Water used as a weapon of war.
In none of these villages there was any piped clean water for people.
A nation in the grip of criminal gangs.
How bad does it have to get before the international community reacts?
A country showing signs of fracture.
Right now with Sudan, things are really quite dark. The nation is divided. The mistrust runs so deep.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service is back for a new series. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.